supervisor at Valentine. He's been working on interpretations, at least back from 1970, when he published a seminal paper on the statistical interpretation at a time when interpretations still didn't even have the consideration it has today. And has been since then working on developing qualities and various aspects of interpretation. He's a Canadian from Alberta, and he's a professor at Simon Fraser University. And he also has produced a textbook in the 90s. The most recent version was with World Scientific. And so I highly recommend the textbook. It has the advantage of teaching you how to use quantum mechanics without invoking too many conceptual ambiguities about meaning and space, which really treats things from a purely operational perspective and has many digressions about the interpretational aspects and pitfalls to be avoided. So with that, please welcome Les Dawson.
Well, it's really a great invitation here. I envy your students who have the opportunity to hear visitors speaking on a topic like this. There certainly wasn't anything like this when I was a student. I understand that discussion is encouraged. I certainly encourage discussion because I don't know where the sticking points will be. You'll be able to tell me. And also, if you don't ask any questions, I'll start talking too fast and I'll do 2 days worth of lectures in one day, which is probably not what we want out. So to begin with, why do we have to talk about the interpretation of quantum mechanics anyway? There's no analogous debate about the interpretation of Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, for example. We just solved Maxwell's equations with appropriate boundary conditions, and that's pretty much it. So why can't we approach quantum mechanics in the same way? There are some people who advocate precisely that you don't need an interpretation of quantum mechanics. And I'm going to argue, contrary to that pragmatic point of view, or instrumentalist point of view, whatever you want to call it, that if all you know about quantum mechanics is the Schrödinger equation and all the necessary mathematical apparatus to solve it, you still won't be able to solve a physical problem in quantum mechanics. Now let me illustrate it with this example here. Okay. We have here, I'm not sure where it works best to make a point here, I think it probably does. We have a source S which produces wave packets. And they pass through a semi-transparent barrier. Half of them goes in the direction of detector D1 and the other half in the direction of D2. And there's a coincidence detector connecting the two D1 and D2. And you know how to solve the Schrödinger equation. You can solve it. You really can solve it. Actually, it's not that difficult. But we know roughly what it consists of anyway. The wave packet will split, and half will go in the direction of D1, and half will go in the direction of D2. And the question is, what do you expect, at least qualitatively, the data to look like? When I see the light is so powerful, we can see right through, and nothing is concealed, so well, let me go directly to the first set of data. All right. How do we do that?
She's getting better on the phone.
Oh, I see. It's automatically focused. It's, when it's hard that it couldn't see through things and change the contrast. Oh, okay. Example of being too clever by half. Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, we have to adopt some kind of interpretation of the wave function in order to proceed. So in the first interpretation, A, I'm going to suppose that the wave packet, rather naively, is to be identified directly with the particle. We might call this naive wave-particle dualism if we want to give it a name. Okay, the wave packet divides, and so half of it goes to D1, half of it goes to D2. It is detected, and you have perfect coincidence between them because there's always half a wave packet in each detector. That's what you predict according to one interpretation. Let me move on to another interpretation.
Leading me over.
We usually hear about Schrödinger's cat. This is the Cheshire cat in Alice in Wonderland. Nothing is left but the grin. Okay, the second interpretation is a little bit different. In the second interpretation, the wave function is not directly observed. However, it has a stochastic influence on the detector. Maybe a detector fires when a wave packet hits it. Maybe it doesn't fire. The probability is given by the square of the wave function, presumably integrated over the volume of the detector, something like that. So it's a stochastic event whether we get a detection at each of the detectors. So sometimes one of them fires, sometimes the other one fires, sometimes they both fire, sometimes they neither fire, and we get a coincidence, right? Literally the word coincidence. When they happen to fire in coincidence, if the probability is P that one of the detectors fires, the probability will be P squared that two of them fire. So according to that interpretation of the wave function, you predict different sorts of death. And then the third level of the Cheshire cat, if it smiles at me, in the third interpretation, the physical object is a particle. What the wave function does is it gives you the probability density of finding the particle at some particular point of space at a particular time. But since the object is a particle, as opposed to in interpretation A, where the object is a wave packet, the particle only goes one way or the other. So if it goes to one, it does not go to two. And so if one fires, the other does not fire, and there's zero. So this example is just intended to show you that you can't get away without an interpretation of quantum mechanics. Probably, I don't need to make this argument to this crowd, but at least you're forewarned if somebody of the pragmatic school says, why are you wasting your time listening to all these lectures on the foundations of quantum mechanics? All you need to know is how to solve the Schrodinger equation. You can hit them with examples, I think. So what was the difference between quantum mechanics and electromagnetic theory? Well, in electromagnetic theory, the electromagnetic field, I was going to say it's directly observable, that's probably an overstatement, but it's certainly observable and we know what to do to observe it. There's no ambiguity about it. In quantum mechanics, things are a little bit more complicated, and we have to pay attention to the fact that the theory involves not only the mathematical formalism, but also a correspondence rule that relates the mathematical quantities to the physical objects. For example, the self-adjoint operator represents a dynamical variable. An eigenvalue of the self-adjoint operator represents possible values of the dynamical variable. And the state vector represents this is where people disagree with each other, see? And that's why there was a problem in the first example, that if you said, well, the state vector means this, the wave function means this, then you said one thing, and if you said the wave function means that, then you said the other thing. So that's at the basis of why we have to talk about the interpretation of quantum mechanics, because the theory is not just the mathematics, it's also the correspondence rules, and the correspondence rules aren't universally agreed upon, I guess. Now, the history of this statistical interpretation goes back to Max Born in 1926. Was there a question? Sorry.
Yes, I'm just focused on the apparatus, you know, the detector. The detector would signal if it detects, it does an AND operation. So.
Yes, it does an AND. That's a coincidence part of it. Okay, well, I'm going to the. Sorry, one other question? Sorry, I'm not.
Sorry, so. Clearly, you're demonstrating that the Schrodinger equation isn't enough, but isn't it a bit of an overstatement to say that their mathematical formalism isn't enough? The mathematical formalism that we're kind of canonically taught has another aspect, which is measurement. People disagree about what this means. And this seems to be what an interpretation is about.
I'm certainly going there. All right. I wouldn't have thought measurement theory was merely part of the mathematical formalism, also involved in correspondence. But we're going there, so this, okay. Others, any more questions before I move on? As I was saying, I'm going back to the history of the statistical interpretation, and it starts with Max Born in 1926. Now, in some respects, Max Born is the Rodney Dangerfield of theoretical physics, in that he got no respect. That is, his work was taken for granted. His probability interpretation forms part of the essential basis of the so-called Copenhagen interpretation. And in his memoirs, in one place, he expresses some resentment that Copenhagen was getting all the credit and Gardner was being ignored. As another example of him not getting the respect he deserves, in the first draft of my 1970 Reviews of Modern Physics paper that Joe referred to, I forgot to refer to him. Fortunately, a referee pointed this out to me, and I corrected the error before it got critical. But the poor guy didn't get the respect he deserves. His Nobel Prize as one of the founders of quantum mechanics came rather late. I could just list some of these Nobel Prizes in quantum mechanics. 1918, it was given to Max Planck. Yes, 1921, it was Albert Einstein. 1922, Niels Bohr. 1929, Louis de Broglie. 1932, Werner Heisenberg. 1933, jointly with Schrodinger and Dirac. 1945, Wolfgang Pauli. And finally, we get down to 1954, it's given to Max Born. It was also with Walter Volta, their important but unrelated work. So you see, he eventually got the credit, but he got overlooked for a long time. There's a reference to Max Born's first paper. It's written in German. The translated title is On the Quantum Mechanics of Collisions. And it's interesting, not only what it does say, but what it doesn't say. In the first place, the probability interpretation was given only to the scattering amplitude. That is, in a scattering situation, you have an incident wave, which is a plane wave, a scattered wave, which is an outgoing spherical wave, and this amplitude is angular dependent, f squared, is the probability, or proportional to the probability, of detecting a particle that's being scattered from the incident direction k to the scattering direction whose angles are theta phi. That, incidentally, was, or interestingly rather, was the only thing that was given a probability interpretation in the original paper. The idea of psi squared being the position probability density, which you're all familiar with, you know, psi of x squared, that's probably the first thing you think of when you think about what does Max Born contribute to physics. Or more generally, if you have a set of eigenfunctions that are eigenfunctions of some observable, and you measure that observable, then the inner product of the state vector and the eigenfunction of the observable gives the probability. Those things came late. They came pretty soon, but they weren't in the original paper. Interesting. This paper was sort of an announcement of a longer one to come, and it's fairly sparse. There's not very much justification for it in terms of why he made this assumption or this interpretation. Let's see. Later on in his memoirs, he credits Albert Einstein with a key idea that gave him his notion, and that was Einstein's idea about photons, that the amplitude, or amplitude squared, intensity of the electromagnetic field was related to density or probability density. I'm not sure whether Einstein was specific about that, but for photons. Einstein had this idea of how photons are related to the electromagnetic field, statistically, and Born took it over for particles.
In his second paper,
he might have. These papers are hard to get if you have a modern library. You have to be at a whole university that has a whole collection, and I haven't found it searching all these things. So I don't know exactly when these things actually came in, but it was fairly soon, but it wasn't in the first paper.
Was it Born himself?
I'm not sure about the second point. I think the second point is also Born himself. I haven't researched all the original papers because they're a little hard to get. But here is Born's actual statement in the first paper. Is that focused well enough?
Can you zoom in?
Okay. It seems to be rather small. Okay. Schrodinger's quantum mechanics therefore gives quite a definite answer to the question of the effect of the collision, but there is no question of any causal description. One gets no answer to the question, what is the state after the collision, but only to the question, how probable is a specific outcome of the collision? That statement stands the test of time pretty well. Quantum mechanics doesn't describe the actual result of a measurement, it describes the probability of various possible results. If I can sort of move forward to a more modern statement, which really just spells out in more detail, this is kind of abstracted from my own writing. Let's see, does that still work? And I didn't invent all these ideas, but they're the ideas that you'll see written out in more detail in my book. Well, a typical experiment consists of preparation and then measurement. You get an individual result, then you repeat number one, do the preparation again, do another measurement, do it again and again and again until you have enough data to estimate the probabilities. The essential statistical nature is seen in various ways. First of all, the same preparation may yield different measurement results. That's a boring thing, I just stated differently. Also, of course, the same measurement result can be obtained from different preparations. The individual results are not reproducible, but the statistical distributions are reproducible if you use the same preparation every time. Okay, the preparation is said to prepare a state. And of course, this begs the question of what is the state? And this is what everybody argues about. But certainly, I think the term state can be identified with a set of probability distributions for each observer. A statement like that, I think, would be acceptable to many different interpretations. It's interesting that when you start talking about one interpretation versus another, there's going to be a lot of overlap between. And we'll see that later on. Another way of expressing it is that the state can be identified with an ensemble of similarly prepared systems on which measurements can be made to reveal the probabilities as relevant frequencies. Now, there's some interesting problems arise at this level. This is a very conceptual level, and yet there's some interesting mathematical problems that I might digress on slightly here. The probabilities for different observables in a particular state cannot all be specified independently. That is, some people like to say we define a state as a catalog of probabilities for all different measures you can. That's fine, but you can't specify these probabilities completely independently. There are constraints. Some compatibility conditions have to be satisfied, such as the famous uncertainty relations on position and momentum, for example. And the next question is, how much do you have to specify in order to uniquely specify the state? This terminology I'm adopted from Henry Margonow. A state is uniquely determined by specifying data on a quorum of non-commuting observables. Why non-commuting observables? Well, if you only measure the probability distribution of a single observable, you'll determine the diagonal elements of the density matrix in that representation. You determine nothing about the octet. So you have to do measurements on non-commuting observables, not simultaneously. You prepare the system and the state, do a measurement, prepare it again, do a measurement on a different observable. And if you do enough of this stuff, you get enough data to uniquely determine the state. An interesting question is precisely how much information is required to uniquely determine the state. There's an elegant answer for this for spin systems, which is discussed in my book. But interestingly, for something as simple as a single particle in free motion, there doesn't seem to be there seems to be some open questions. Pauli first raised this question, I think it was 1933 or thereabouts, approximately. He says, suppose we specify position probability, all right, it's a modern terminology, and we specify momentum probability. The answer is that sufficient to determine the state? And the answer is no, this is not sufficient. It's easy to find examples of two different states that have the same position distribution and momentum distribution, but are different from one another. I give some examples in my textbook. The question that remains open is exactly how much more information do you have to specify in order to make it unique? That is, this is not sufficient. How much is both necessary and sufficient? How much more information gives you, makes the answer unique? I don't know the answer to that question. In particular, I don't know the answer to how non-unique it is. The only examples of non-uniqueness I know are discrete pairs that are related by some kind of a symmetry. I don't know whether all non-uniqueness is symmetry related, and this doesn't seem to have a definite answer in the literature. Maybe some people will want to talk about this later if there are no in the literature that I don't. No, not about the global phase. That's about unique apart from the global phase. The global phase you never. That's the relative phase.
Relative phase state expressed
global phase. Well, yes.
Partly specified
the unique phase. No, the point was if you just measure one observable, that's not enough. That's obviously not enough. You've got to measure something non-commuting. The question is, how many non-commuting states? Position and momentum are obvious candidates. Turns out that's not enough. How much more do you have to add? I don't know the answer.
There are examples of wave functions, specific wave functions for which that information will characterize it.
Well, take the orbital angular momentum state and consider the states for plus m and minus m. That's an example of two states that have the same position momentum distributions and but they're different wavelengths.
But the opposite, other examples which this would be sufficient.
I'm not quite sure. I I'm pointing this out as some open questions here. I don't quite know the answer to your questions. Now what else? Okay, that's the sufficiency. Okay, we now know that specifying just this amount of information doesn't make them unique, doesn't make the state unique. What about the compatibility condition? That is, suppose I give you a position distribution and I give you a momentum distribution, or rather, I give you a probability distribution that I allege to be a position distribution, and I give you a momentum distribution that I allege to be a momentum distribution. Does there exist a quantum state that satisfies? You know the answer to that is obviously no. If make them too narrow and they violate the uncertainty principle, then it'll be impossible. So okay, I'm going to make them wide and satisfy the uncertainty principle. Is that enough? I'll tell you the answer. It's not. There are other constraints, and I don't think anybody has ever tackled the problem of enumerating all these constraints. So this is just to point out that there's some interesting questions concerning the notion of state that arise naturally if you identify the state with a set of probability distributions. And since that's the sort of thing that is done in many interpretations of quantum mechanics, I think they're interesting problems. So I'm not giving you the answer, I'm just telling you there's a problem. Okay, this course of lectures is supposedly about different interpretations of quantum mechanics, and you've heard from Joe about a lot of them. So I want to pose you the question. Rhetorical question. What's in a name? Copenhagen interpretation, orthodox interpretation, statistical interpretation. Precisely what do those mean? You see, in my 1970 paper, I criticized something that I called Copenhagen interpretation. And one class of responses that I got was from people who said, yeah, we agree with you that the interpretation that you criticized is no good. But that's not the Copenhagen interpretation. The Copenhagen interpretation is something else. And again, orthodox. I would have thought that Bohr, Heisenberg, von Neumann, and Wigner were all orthodox. But I had some correspondence with Henry Stapp around 1971, and he was having correspondence with Leon Rosenfeld. And according to Rosenfeld, von Neumann and Wigner were not orthodox. And also, he even dismissed Heisenberg for certain things. So there's not too much in these names. I'll give you some examples from the way I've used them. This is from, I guess you can't read it all. Read it to staff. There's a reference given. By the way, I gave out a bibliography in advance of this, and Joe has disseminated it electronically, so you know what my principal references are. So this is my own writing. What is meant by the Copenhagen interpretation? I shall use the term in its popular, but not necessarily historically accurate sense, my qualification is because of my correspondence with staff, as including the following propositions. A state vector provides a complete description of an individual system, that is to say, the views of Bohr rather than the views of Einstein in their famous controversy. Secondly, the state vector evolves according to the Schrödinger equation while the state is isolated, but changes discontinuously during measurement to an eigenstate of the observable that is measurement, this being von Neumann's projection function. And of course, there's more to Copenhagen's interpretation of that, but I interpreted it as including exactly at least that amount. If anybody doesn't agree that that's the Copenhagen interpretation, then let's not argue about names. What I say is, let's not talk about names of interpretations, specify your postulates, and then we'll discuss those postulates.
Maybe it's worth pointing out to students that, by way of comparison, this is what I was calling the orthodox interpretation.
Are you saying Copenhagen isn't orthodox? That's like saying the Vatican isn't orthodox. Okay, here's a little more. Okay, quoting myself here. Some will not like my terminology. Leon Rosenfeld has said, "We in Copenhagen do not like the phrase Copenhagen interpretation as dogma." Indeed, this expression was invented and is used by people wishing to suggest that there may be other interpretations, namely their own muddle ones. Thus, not only the interpretation of quantum mechanics is controversial, but the existence of a controversy is controversial. Because to have a controversy, you've got to have two interpretations, at least, and Rosenfeld won't grant that. Well, when we start discussing the relative merits of different interpretations of quantum mechanics, we sort of leave Max Born behind, and Einstein becomes the chief spokesman. Max Born wasn't terribly sensitive to these matters. Einstein's interpretation he didn't arrive at immediately, but here's some statements that indicated evolution. To Schrödinger in 1926, "I am convinced that you have made a decisive advance with your formulation of the quantum condition, just as I am equally convinced that the Heisenberg-Born route is off the track." That sounds a little strange to us because we know that the Schrödinger and Heisenberg approaches are equivalent to each other. Now, maybe that wasn't known already in April of 1926, I'm not quite sure. Or maybe he's hinting at something deeper, that even though they're mathematically equivalent, they're conceptually inequivalent. I'm not sure exactly what qualification he had in mind. And then a little later on to Max Born in December of 1926, "Quantum mechanics is certainly imposing, but an inner voice tells me that it is not yet the real thing. Theory says a lot, but does not really bring us any closer to the secret of the old one. I, at any rate, am convinced that he is not playing dice." Several comments are in order about that quote. First of all, Einstein's talk about God is purely metaphorical in the same sense that we talk about Mother Nature and Father Time. I know that because he wrote some specific essays about science and religion, in which he said a number of positive things about religion, but says there's one thing on which they're wrong, and that's the notion of a personal God. So he definitely did not believe in a personal God. Also, another anecdote I remember, some rabbi telegraphed him and said, "Do you believe in God?" Prepaid reply to make sure he answered. And Einstein answered. He said, "I believe in the God of Spinoza," which was a very clever response because it meant the rabbi now had to go and read Spinoza. He might learn something if he did so. Secondly, Spinoza was expelled from the synagogue on the grounds that he was an atheist. His objections to indeterminism is more serious, but I think it's overemphasized. His serious criticisms of the Copenhagen interpretation, in the sense that he and I use the word, didn't involve determinism versus indeterminism. It involved realism or ontological questions. This can be seen particularly clearly in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosenberg. I'm not sure whether you've seen this, probably yes, okay, that means I can go over it fairly quickly. There's a couple of important definitions. First of all, a necessary condition for a complete description is that every element of physical reality must have a counterpart in a physical theory. Okay, now what's an element of reality? Well, they don't define it precisely, but to say a sufficient condition for identifying an element of reality is if without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty, that is, with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this quantity. They go on for an example, and let's see, where's the eraser?
It's just why the
illumination seems fair if you don't have a small picture. What they do is then they prepare a state that's an eigenstate of two commuting operators, Q2 minus Q1, or Q and these are the positions of the two particles, and P1 plus P2, the total momentum and the relative position. You can check about the trivial of those operators commute, so perfectly orthodox quantum mechanics that an eigenstate exists. So an eigenstate of this, for instance, let's say it has the eigenvalue x naught, that's a number, and this one has the eigenvalue 0, just to give it a number. Then what we can do, we could measure Q1, but since the difference between Q1 and Q2 is definite, if we measure Q1, we can infer Q2 without disturbing the second system. Or if we choose, we can measure P1, but because the sum is known, we can infer P2 without disturbing the system. And then the crux of the argument comes in the next statement. Since neither of these measurements would disturb the second system, the reality, the elements of reality of system number 2 can't depend on what we do or do not do to number 1. Therefore, both Q2 and P2 are both elements of reality. Of course, there's no eigenfunction that can, there's no wave function that can describe definite values of both of these. And so they conclude that the quantum mechanical description of reality is incomplete. Now, I think the important part of their argument that survives today is that it focuses us on the problem of reality and ontology. Completeness is no longer an issue, I don't think. Everybody knows that theories aren't complete for the sake. That's part of it needs to be argued. But the important thing is that determinism is irrelevant. Even though Einstein probably did believe in determinism and thought that the physical theory should be deterministic, he didn't try to convince anybody using that kind of an argument. Determinism simply wasn't used. Okay, let's see. So I quoted Einstein in 1926. This is Einstein in 1936, where he's got his interpretation of quantum mechanics much clearer. It seems clear, therefore, that Born's statistical interpretation of quantum theory is the only possible one. Notice how 10 years ago he said Heisenberg-Born approach was off the track. Here he's embraced Born's aspect of it. The psi function does not in any way describe a state which could be that of a single system. It relates rather to many systems, to an ensemble of systems in the sense of statistical mechanics. If, except for certain special cases, the psi function furnishes only statistical data concerning measurable magnitudes, the reason lies not only in the fact that the operation of measurement includes unknown elements which can only be grasped statistically, but because of the fact that the psi function does not, in any sense, describe the state of one single system. So that's Einstein in 1936. And then in a letter to Schrödinger in 1939, he reiterates the same thing and concludes by saying, "I am convinced as ever that the wave function representation of matter is an incomplete representation of the state of affairs. The prettiest way to show this is by your example with the cat." So we're then to Schrödinger's cat. Inevitably we get there sooner or later. But I'd like to preface it with a quote from my friend Phil Pearl, which I think puts it in perspective very well. Doesn't get it perfected very well because of the technology here, but let's get it. Okay. "The problem with quantum mechanics, the quantum theory, has never been a measurement problem. We have long known how to describe measurements. The problem is how to describe reality." Now, I'm going to spend a fair amount of time saying that von Neumann's collapse of the wave function or the projection postulate doesn't belong to quantum theory. I think Phil Pearl's coming next week to talk about spontaneous collapse. You might therefore think that we're adversaries. Nothing could be further from the truth. Phil and I are great friends. We agree on almost everything about quantum mechanics. The only thing that we disagreed on initially is how what chances of success he would have with his spontaneous collapse theory, I figured that it would be pretty darn easy to find a contradiction with the experiment once you got the theory formulated. The theory, of course, contains an adjustable parameter, so it's not quite so easy. And he's done a really good job with that stuff. But the point of view that he expresses right there is the one that I'm using too. Okay, just to reiterate in my own words what I quoted Phil as saying, the purpose of talking about the quantum theory of measurement, the so-called measurement problem, and the Schrödinger cat paradox are precisely the same thing. They illustrate situations in which different interpretations of quantum mechanics lead to different conclusions. This is important because in the majority of situations, in fact, you don't need to be definite on your interpretation of quantum mechanics. You have to sort of work at it to find a situation in which a person who advocates one interpretation will come to a different conclusion from a person who advocates another. And the problem in measurement is important because it's such a situation. Okay, now, I understand that you've been through the theory of measurement under Joe's tutelage, so that's good for me because I can just emphasize the main points and what it implies, and I won't have to go into the mathematical technical details. But the essential idea is that we have an object in the initial state Q sub I. Q sub I is an eigenvector of some observable, capital Q. Initial state of the measurement apparatus, A naught. We define an interaction between them such that by a unitary transformation, we go from the initial state, qi, a naught, to qi, a sub I. That's if the state of the system being measured doesn't change. If it does change, it changes into phi sub f, or final state or something. But that's of no importance. The important thing is that there's a unique correspondence established between the initial value of the thing you're trying to measure, q sub I, and the final value of the apparatus, pointer position, that's called. And a trivial theorem then says that if the initial state of the object is a linear combination of q1 and q2, then the final state of the object plus apparatus will be the equation written at the bottom, which is enough so everyone can see it clearly. And the point is that it's a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct apparatus pointer position states. So the purpose of this analysis, the value of this analysis is to show that entangled superpositions of macroscopically distinct states are not pathological or rare. Rather, it's the factored states that are rare. So we've got to come to grips with what we mean by these entangled states or macroscopic superpositions. I shouldn't be garbling my words. Coherent superpositions of macroscopically distinct states. It's something we have to come to grips with across the gaps. And coming to grips with it is something that is easier or more difficult depending on what interpretation of quantum mechanics we have. So in the first interpretation, which in 1970 I called it the Copenhagen interpretation, but I'm just going to call it interpretation number one. State vector provides a complete description of an individual statement, and the most important statement is the second one. A dynamical variable q has a value, little q, say, if and only if it's an eigenvector of the, if the current state vector is an eigenvector of the operator. This is problematic in the measurement process, of course, because we don't have an eigenvector of the apparatus pointer position. It's a coherent superposition. So people who believe in number one are driven to introduce von Neumann's projection problem. If, on the other hand, you adopt this, what I call a statistical interpretation in 1970, but I'm just calling interpretation number two, if the state vector describes the probability distributions of all the observables in an ensemble of similarly prepared systems, then, well, just calculate them from that state vector, and that's what's predicted. So there's no requirement. The eigenvalue eigenvector link isn't a requirement. Let's go on with a hypothetical debate between a supporter of interpretation number one and a supporter of interpretation number two. So the supporter of interpretation number one says, but we never observe macroscopic objects to be in a superposition state. How do you know? Have you ever looked as a supporter of interpretation number two? So let's look in a little bit more a little bit more simplified situation than the one I just described. But let's consider not the entangled state, but just a macroscopic coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct states, but it's only a single system, it's not an entangled state. So we have a wave packet, 5x, and a displaced wave packet, 5x plus a, and they do not overlap. Probability distribution is the square of the sum, but since they don't overlap, it's also equal to the sum of the squares. So there's no difference, there's no interference effect observed, and it doesn't matter whether you invoke some kind of a projection postulate or a decoherence effect or anything else to get rid of the interference, because what? However, that's not the whole story. Look at other dynamical variables. The momentum probability density, for example, take the Fourier transform of the wave function, take the sum of the Fourier transforms and square them, and you see that there is going to be an interference pattern, very fine grain. A is the difference between the two wave packets. If it's macroscopic, that interference pattern is going to be really, really fine grain. And unless you're a really, really good experimenter, you can isolate your system and got really excellent apparatus, you just won't see it. So the interpretation that I'm advocating is that, yes, these interference patterns really exist. Mostly we can't see them because they're too fine, but if we do better experiments, we will see them, and we'll find that, the superposition state really exists, and it didn't collapse. The collapse possibly dropped. So that's what I'm saying. And I'll be justifying that with some examples later on. I'd like to express my point of view in a little.
Put down the paper on it.
What?
Use the down paper there.
You're right. All right. Okay. I'd like to express my conclusion in terms of this little paradox. The measurement problem is insoluble, the measurement problem is solved. And it's all a matter of conceptual aspect of it. The measurement problem, if viewed as the problem of explaining how the reduction of the state vector comes about, is insoluble. That's incompatible with the unitarity of the Schrödinger equation. The measurement problem, viewed as seeking an interpretation of the formalism that is compatible with the existence of entangled macroscopic superpositions, that's what I called the measurement theory before, is solved if we adopt an ensemble interpretation which does not require a state reduction process. There are a number of myths about quantum measurement, which I'd just like to mention here. Myth number one, the reduction or collapse of the state vector is caused by uncontrollable disturbance of the object by the measuring apparatus. That, I think, is due to Heisenberg. In fact, the interaction between the object and the apparatus leads to the macroscopically entangled state. It doesn't lead to the reduced state. There's a whole bunch of technical details that I left out because I figured you'd already covered them with Joe. I didn't take into account the fact that the apparatus state is extremely degenerate because it's got Avogadro's number of quantum numbers, and it should be described by a density matrix rather than a state vector. All that can be done. It doesn't change the conclusion. It's in my book if you want to read it. It's other places too. Second myth, the observer causes the reduction when he reads the apparatus. Wigner said something to that effect. The fact, which I'm asserting to be a fact now, is that Wigner did not believe this to be true. He intended it as a reduction ad absurdum. The reason I'm saying that is because I once had the privilege of talking about quantum theory of measurement and its influence on the interpretation of quantum mechanics at a conference in which Wigner was sitting in the front row and paying lots of attention. And when I got to this point, I said to him, I'm not quite sure how seriously you take this conclusion. And he said, well, I don't believe that it's true, but I believe that it follows from the fossil. Which is much the reductio ad absurdum. He didn't indicate what he thought needed to be changed about the postulates. Third myth is that the apparatus must be classical. Niels Bohr was very insistent on that. In fact, there's no boundary between the quantum and the classical domains. We're seeing that more and more today as technology advances. Presumably, quantum mechanics is a more general theory, and quantum mechanics emerges from it in some kind of a limit. That limiting process is rather subtle, not just mathematically subtle, but conceptually subtle, and I'll have a bit to say about that in my Thursday lecture. The fourth myth There's an environmental decoherence causes an effective reproduction of the entangled state, and that mess is due to Wojciech Zurek, who is a... He should be in marketing physics. That's what it sounds like. In fact, interaction with the environment only makes the entanglement even more macroscopic, which makes the problem worse, as I'm about to argue here. So I want to talk a bit about decoherence. First of all, a proper, a good use of decoherence, and secondly, bad or inappropriate use of decoherence. I'm not sure how this goes. Okay, it's all on except for the title. This is your classic double slit type of interference. You don't have to change it. It's just the title. The title's not here. We've got a beam comes in, it's split, goes either up or down. The wave function for the upper beam is psi 1, lower beam is psi 2. They recombine. Total wave function is psi 1 plus psi 2. Position probability density is the square of the wave function, and it contains interference terms. This analysis is the standard one that takes no account of the interaction with the environment. Let us see what difference it makes when we take the interaction with the environment into account. Well, we have environmental states, E1 and E2. The particle presumably interacts with the environment. And if it goes along the upper path, it will interact differently than if it goes along the lower path. And not only does the environment have an influence on the system has a back reaction on the environment, and the environmental state can change as a result of this back reaction. So when we now calculate the position probability density tracing over the environmental states, we see that the magnitude of the interference terms is reduced by the inner product of these two environmental terms. So we have two extremes. If the environment isn't affected at all, the interference pattern remains full visibility. More importantly, actually, for practical purposes, if the interaction around the two paths has the same effect on the environment, not a differential effect, that is E1 and so that the environment state can change, so long as it changes in the same way, then there's no problem. But if it affects them differentially, then there's a reduction in the interference amplitude. And in the extreme case, where the environmental states are orthogonal to each other, you can actually tell which path the particle took by doing some measurement on the environment. And there's no interference. That is what I call a good use of decoherence. It's very important from a practical point of view. Here's a bad use of decoherence, where it doesn't have any useful effect at all. And that, try to recap problem, same thing as the quantum measurement problem. We have a system which is an unstable atom and a cat. I suppose everybody's heard of this, but the cat and the atom are placed in a chamber. When the atom decays, it releases a poison and kills the cat. We wait for one half-life so that the state vector will contain equal terms of undecayed and decayed atom, and will also be correlated with equal terms of live and dead cat. So this is a superposition of macroscopically distinct terms. So the problem is the conceptual problem. What is the meaning of a state vector that's a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct terms? This is what the problem of measurement was all about. This is what people argued about. Or this is why they argued about it. If nobody cared about the answer to this question, nobody would have ever worried about the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. That's what our decoherence. That's what the environment is. So the system is the unstable atoms of the cat and the environment. We have atom state, cat state, environmental state. It's still a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct terms. We have exactly the same problem. If anything, decoherence has made the situation worse, because by creating entanglement with the environment, that's even more macroscopic than we had without the environment. Decoherence is utterly irrelevant to the conceptual problems of quantum mechanics, and it's certainly utterly irrelevant to the measurement problem and try to get cat problem. You want to say something else?
If I check your egg with LD, let us solve one problem there. You would say that would explain if the environment is orthogonal, E1 and U are orthogonal to each other. This would prevent seeing the cat being live and dead at the same time.
You don't see the cat live and dead at the same time. That's misinterpreting quantum. The state vector is a catalog of probabilities, and probability seeing him alive is a half, probability seeing him dead is a half. It's really a non sequitur what he's saying. I haven't talked to him in person about this, but what's the difference between this, conceptually, I mean, and this? We've got a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct states, we've got entanglement of macroscopically distinct states, and there is a conceptual problem as to what we mean by those things, but it's the same conceptual problem with and without the environment. It's just more severe with these coherence.
Something which we add is even the original formulation, the atomic states, which are not directly observed, already serve the role of field markers since they are atomic and the K state.
That's true. Yeah, that's true too.
So the cat state itself is already in a coherent superposition.
Well, you mean if you trace over the under degrees of freedom, what I call a partial state, but
if you go through the basis of undecayed decay. So when we get, instead of undecayed, then undecayed plus decayed.
Yeah.
Well, I would save one with a minus with that. And I think the question that Zurek was trying to answer, and other people were promoting the current, was that we do not see cats in the superposition of land and day. We do see the bare spin in superposition of
We don't see just cat in superposition of alive and dead, but we do see cat in this detangled state, which is a superposition of alive and dead. And so is this one. Zurich not the static.
But when I open the box, the claim is, or whatever gets you.
When you open the box, you're part of the environment. So, I mean, I don't have to change anything to answer that.
But I don't. Except for superconductivity is a conversion. Nowadays, where we do see microscopic superposition, or CFS microscopic superposition. In most of the microscopic world, we don't see superposition of human dealing or. And which is one of the claims that the people in promoting the glorious say that they have solved.
Yeah, well, you're sort of going back to what I already answered here. What would that macroscopic superposition look like? The one that you claim we don't see. It would have some really, really fine super probability interference patterns, which we can't see.
Because I work out.
But I claim we would. I claim they're there, and we just can't see them.
Yeah.
But however, there's one crucial difference. Let's put it here. This is an entangled state. Use the language of Glauber's language of coherence, first and second order coherence. The state has second order coherence, it doesn't have first order coherence, if you know what I mean by those terms.
I bet there are a lot of people who don't.
Well, it's okay, there's going to be an example of it coming up soon. So it's made up, it's better done in the context of quantum optics than the context of Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger's cat's a little bit.
I have to say something, not really in defense of Zimmer, I like basically written in criticism. The environmental states that he has there, you want to be are more than just a final. They're super final. So are final that no future interventions you can make overcome that finality, and that at least that's an important
super
role.
Super orthogonality is not a concept that I'm familiar with. Orthogonality is an inner product equal to zero, and there's no smaller value.
No, it's a clear enough notion. It's such that you can't. What it's asking is an orthogonality is not overlaps. Mm-hmm. And if the non overlap is so. The piece E1 and E2 are so. Are supported on regional configuration space, which is initially distant. It would be very hard to undo that. Mm-hmm. And that's very important for this work. Mm-hmm. That's important for other points of view. There is some point to introducing E1 and E2. Now, your criticism would still stand, but it wasn't utterly pointless.
Well, there's certainly a value to the coherence theory, but he seems to really overstep the bounds. Make the claim beyond what it justifies.
Can you repeat precisely what is the. Your comment where
where they say that the coherence is responsible for the appearance of the classical world. That's way. Scott?
Just to jump in a little on this discussion, those who believe in the kind of many worlds that you heard about a couple of weeks ago, I think Wojciech is one of those. I'm pretty sure he's a many worlds.
I didn't think so.
So that's my comment, is only to those who use decoherence within the many worlds.
Interpretations do overlap, as I said earlier.
Yes.
Make the comment anyway, whether it's there or not.
So they use decoherence as a kind of signal that the branches have split. That's why it's important in their conceptual framework. It's the thing that authorizes you to talk about two different branches. I'm not supporting that, but I just just to clarify why it can be an important conceptual.
Yeah, I see why it's important for them. I wasn't intending to talk about the many worlds interpretation, but I don't think Zurich holds the many worlds interpretation. I think he holds that you can get away without the many worlds and have all the benefits.
Not
absolutely sure.
If you try to get
Zurich
to come here,
it's
exactly what you think.
Okay, how are we doing for time? Okay. I think it's going pretty well. Okay, shall I move on? Next topic?
Okay, I think it's the same question we've been debating on the whole time. But we still don't see macroscopic superpositions. It's one thing to say when you're all the way.
Well, I just said we do. You just don't recognize them. You can't tell whether they're coherent or not unless you do observations much more careful than what you did.
Supervision of superposition, of large objects, cats are a fine example, not the death, what do you do? If I look at a cat, I touch it or poke it or do something, I see something that looks very much like the alive plus undecayed plus T1 state, and I don't see why I should suspect there's in fact someone there. If you had some mechanism,
I think
where they were back to this culture, that would be one thing, but I don't see that's the case.
Okay, maybe this is restating the problem, but I think what Phil Pearl said, and I quoted, is very much the point. The problem is the description of reality, and I'm taking the point of view that quantum mechanics provides only a statistical description of reality, that is, it does not describe exact actual events. Or to take Niels Bohr's terminology and use it against him, quantum mechanics does not describe the phenomenon. It describes the probabilities of the different possible phenomena.
I think that whatever you're saying, look, I don't ever see coherence of position in space.
Yeah.
There's an implicit assumption in that point of view. The implicit assumption is that vectors in total space, in mathematical objects, represent states of physical reality. If they exist out there, they would look different with incoherence of positions when you do a single measurement on a single system. So that's your implicit assumption. And I agree with you, if you take the assumption that states are physical, then you're led to conclude that I don't see something different when I observe a coherent versus incoherent superposition, and then you need to coherence to explain that. If you have that assumption, which, for example, doesn't mean that I disagree with it, you're starting from a point of view that you disagree with your assumptions, your conclusion is kind of irrelevant. The key point is that you assume it's not.
Someone else find out a question down here?
Given that that's true, I was going to ask if there's a way to put a bound on the degree of the interference that we're, in this regard, in fact, the state's physical thing at all.
Well, no, you can calculate the interference pattern because that's just calculating the probabilities that are predicted by quantum mechanics. And I showed you in an earlier slide that environmental effects are very important there, or they may be very important, and that all has to be taken into account in practical experiments where you're trying to see interference. Okay, for now. I wanted to say a little bit about the uncertainty principle, or as Heisenberg and I prefer to call it, the indeterminacy principle. No, I'm not a buddy with Heisenberg, but just maybe I'll just Okay, you probably heard all this, but let me just go through it briefly. We prepare a state, we measure Q, we prepare it again and measure Q again, and we collect a bunch of statistics. We prepare the same state to measure T and again, we collect a bunch of statistics. We have these two empirically determined frequency distributions, which are measures of probability. And there's a theorem due to Robertson and Schrodinger, not due to Heisenberg, that says the product of the width of these two distributions has a lower bound, which is h bar over 2. I'm just taking some things out of my book here and saying that delta Q and delta P that are described here should not be interpreted as errors of measurements. And indeed, the experimental test of this inequality does not involve simultaneous measurements of Q and P. Rather, it involves what I just said, prepare the state, measure Q or P, prepare the state again, measure one or the other. You've got to do some of all until you get enough statistics. But at no time you try to measure Q and P simultaneously. Another way of putting it is that this inequality refers to state preparation rather than measurement. That is, it's a property of states. It's not a property of the measurement. That said, it is possible to say, OK, what would happen if you really did do a simultaneous measurement of Q and P? Heisenberg's analysis I don't find satisfactory because it's what I call pseudo-classical. He analyzes things classically, and then he throws in a bit of uncertainty at some point, or throws in wave particle duality. It's not a consistent analysis. But what you really can do, I don't think you can see it, you can couple a Q measuring device and a P measuring device to the same Hamiltonian. I have in mind here, seems like running out of voice. If you can easily construct a Hamiltonian that would describe the interaction for measuring one point. Q, say. Von Neumann did that correctly. Got nothing to do with projection modulus. He did lots of things that were right. And you can do the same thing for P. What happens if you do them both at the same time? Stenholm wasn't the first person to show this, but he showed it most clearly to my mind. And that is that if you do this and optimize the choices of parameters, the statistical distribution of results from your simultaneous QP measurements will obey the so-called Cassini distribution, which is obtained by projecting the state vector onto a minimum uncertainty state of which little q and little p are the average momentum. And the Cassini distribution is a kind of a fuzzy phase-space distribution. It's the closest thing in quantum mechanics to a phase-space distribution that you can compare with a classical phase-space distribution. It's a Gaussian in Q and it's a Gaussian in P. It's a Gaussian state, but with the mean momentum and the mean position shifted off. A minimum uncertainty state. That's it. Let's see, I could write it down. Like e to the minus some number. I don't want to use a different symbol than anything written down there because I type e to the minus q to the minus q naught squared, and then we got to multiply by e to the I p naught times q, I guess. This would be the with the right with the appropriate one. So what is obtained from the result of this is an inequality. The half widths of the Hazemi distribution satisfy an inequality similar to the Robertson inequality, but with a factor of 2 larger on the right-hand side. An interpretation that you can give for this, which I think is correct, but it's sort of a contextual interpretation, is that both the system and the measurement device are quantum mechanical, so their states both have built into them this uncertainty that really shouldn't be called an uncertainty, but the inevitable minimal spread that exists in any quantum state, the one that's described by the Robertson inequality that I showed you earlier. So I don't know whether we should now say that Heisenberg has been vindicated. Certainly a result very similar to what Heisenberg argued for can actually be derived in quantum mechanics, but the theorem that's usually quoted, called the uncertainty principle, definitely does not correspond to what Heisenberg is talking about. So maybe we should give Heisenberg a little bit more respect than I gave him when I wrote my 1970 thing. No, we didn't.
But that sort of measurement was
approximate
measurement. Of course,
it's approximate.
So the fact that it's approximate
probably
introduces
more squares.
No, I don't think
so. Well, I certainly agree that it's approximate measurement, and that's necessarily the case. And the fact that you got an additional factor of 2 in the delta p delta q inequality, maybe that describes what you're talking about. I'm not sure whether it does or not. Okay. In discussing the relative merits of different interpretations, we can argue on the basis of logical economy, economy of postulates, naturalness or unnaturalness of postulates. Some people are not satisfied with this. They want to say, all right, but once you've done all this talking, does it really make any difference? Does it really make any difference in what you actually and practically did? And most of the time the answer is no, but I claim there are some of the time when the answer is yes. And what I'm particularly arguing here is that interpretations that require the projection postulate are objectively inferior to interpretations such as the ensemble interpretation that do not. So I'm not really arguing one specific interpretation against another specific interpretation, but one class of interpretation versus another class. I'm referring to a paper of mine called Limitations of the Projection Postulate, but the original title was The Projection Postulate is Either Redundant or Wrong. There was some negotiation involved. what I mean here is, you have to, in order for it to make a difference, you have to consider 2 successive measurements. So it's the final state for the first measurement is the initial state for the first. A priori, it appears like it might make a difference whether you introduce the projection postulate at the end of each measure. Because if you introduce a projection postulate after completion of the first measurement, you'll have different initial states of input for the second measurement. Certainly, you'll have a different state vector, but that doesn't necessarily mean you get different results, because quantum mechanics just predicts the probabilities of the measurement results, doesn't predict the measurement results themselves, and maybe those probabilities are the same, and maybe they're different. And there are lots of situations in which they're the same, but there are also situations in which they're different. And I discussed several such cases in this paper, and I'll discuss one or two of them today. Now, by the projection postulate, I mean precisely this, the statement coming from von Neumann, I guess. Upon measurement, the state of the system collapses to an eigenstate of the observable that was measured. So what I want to do is test whether it makes a difference at all, and if it does make a difference, who's right, who's wrong. As I said, you must consider 2 measurements. So I'm going to consider here a schematic 2 measurements. We've got a 2-component system with observables Q and R. They belong to 2 different systems. So they certainly commute. Q has a bunch of eigenvectors, little Q sub I, and R has a bunch of eigenvectors, little R sub I. The 2-component state vector is a linear combination of the tensor product phase. If we ask for the joint probability for the 2 measurements, that Q will have the value Q sub I, and R will have the value R sub I, then it's just the square of this coefficient, Aij squared, max 1. Tend to take him for granted, don't we? That's what he's saying. Not in his first paper, but in his second, I think. Now, if we ask, what is the conditional probability for a result of the second R measurement, it's conditional on having already gotten a particular result for the first. So the first measurement, we get the result Q is equal to Q sub I. Well, you can easily calculate what that probability is by the rules of probability theory. Just hold I constant and regard this as a function of J. It has to be renormalized to make the probabilities add up to 1. Question in fact.
You mean in the equation for psi, Q sub I tensor R sub I sub J?
You're absolutely right. Just a minute, we'll fix that up.
Can you help
fix that.
Okay. Okay, that's what you get from just applying Born's probability rule to a system where you have two measurements rather than one. Now, the projection postulate introduced after the first Q measurement, it collapses the state to psi prime, in which you just throw away all the terms in which Q wasn't equal to Q sub I. All the terms where I had a different value. So you no longer have the double sum, but you have only a single sum, and only Q sub I appears. Different values of R sub J still appear, and you have to renormalize the state factor to make it have norm one, and now you calculate the probability that the second measurement will yield the result R sub I, and it gives you exactly the same result for the conditional probability that you got in the first measurement, or the first analysis. That is to say, the projection postulate made no difference whatsoever, except in the birth. So there's a large class of situations in which the projection postulate is completely innocuous. Use it or don't use it, you get the same result. Here's a situation that looks simple. It's a two-photon state in a two-mode electromagnetic field. Now, okay, I'm not sure how much people know about quantum theory of the electromagnetic field, but you represent the electric field by operators. And the electric field operators are conventionally divided into positive frequency and negative frequency parts called E plus and E minus. A1 and A2 are the annihilation operators for photons in the two modes, modes 1 and modes 2, which are plane wave modes with wave vectors K1 and K2. K's and X's are vectors, I just didn't draw arrows at the top. E minus is the Hermitian conjugate, so A dagger, A1 dagger, A2 dagger are the creation operators for photons in these two modes. Now, according to Glauber's theory, the probability of detecting a photon at position X is E minus of X times E plus of X, and take the average in the quantum state that you deal. So you have one pair of electric field operators. The probability of detecting a photon at each of x1 and x2 involves two pair of field operators. So this is E minus x1, E minus x2, E plus x2, A plus x1. We evaluate these quantities in a one-photon state where there's one photon in each mode. It's not terribly difficult, but it's a little too much algebra for me to stand here and do in front of you. You see, when you do this substitution, there's going to be four terms here, there's going to be 16 terms here. When you introduce a particular state, a large number of terms give zero, and the annihilation operator try to annihilate a photon that isn't there, or something to that effect. And if you do the calculation for this, the G1 quantity, which has four terms, it turns out that the e to the ikx always cancels at e to the minus ikx, and the one photon probability distribution is uniform. However, the two photon distribution involves correlations. I think there's four of the 16 terms divide. Not a difficult calculation, just ground my ability to do it standing. Right. This is what's meant by second order coherence. If you just have a single photon detector, which is how we usually detect interference patterns, that's called first order coherence. There is no first order coherence to be observed. But if you have two detectors and you do coherence measurements with them, you can detect what's called second order coherence. Okay, this is a two-component system. It looks like the analysis of the previous situation might apply. These are the correct results. Let's see what we would get if we try to apply the projection postulate. First place, it seems to me that the application of the projection postulate is ambiguous. It's not quite clear to what it should collapse. Remember von Neumann said, the state after measurement collapses to an eigenstate of the quantity that was measured. I discuss more possibilities in my paper that I've discussed here on this transparency. Taken literally, it sounds like it should collapse to something like position eigenstate. That's obviously wrong because, for all sorts of reasons, a localized state has to have higher frequency components, would have to have gained energy. It doesn't gain energy, it loses energy. We have absorbed, we haven't created any photons. But more plausibly, we started with a two-photon state, we absorb one photon, maybe it collapses to a one-photon state. There are two single-photon states. Photon could be the first photon, could be the second photon. That can't be right, because the conditional probability of detecting the second photon would be spatially uniform, and that would mean it's not correlated with the result of the first measurement where you detected the first photon. The photons are correlated. So that can't be right. Maybe it collapses to a superposition of these two states, because after all, we don't know which photon is being absorbed. So I put in an unknown alpha 1, alpha and beta as my coefficients. That does give an interference pattern in the detection of the second photon. Trouble is, the phase of the interference pattern depends on the phase of the alpha and beta, and the projection postulate doesn't tell us how to get that phase. So the projection postulate is either ambiguous or resolve the ambiguity in some plausible way, wrong. So in this case, you definitely must not apply the projection postulate after the first measurement, or you get the wrong answer. Now, question? Yeah?
In the state collapse, it doesn't seem as though you're actually getting components of the original two-photon state. It seems to me that what you're postulating it would collapse to would be something that you do not see as a component of the two-photon state. So I'm curious what you mean by, I'm curious why you say that it would collapse to states such as this.
First of all, you really should be asking this question of somebody who believes in state vector collapse, and I don't. Therefore, I have to guess what he would mean in this experiment, and I've taken two guesses, both plausible, and they both give the wrong answer. But the reason for saying this is we have a two-photon state, we absorb one photon in the first measurement, what's left is one photon.
What's left is one photon, but basically, if you weren't doing simultaneous observation, then doesn't it evolve further afterwards?
It does, well, I simplified the theory. You can put time in, and you can do delayed coincidence experiments, and equivalent results can be obtained for that. So conceptually,
I suppose I'm just basically given the mathematical formalism for what it okay, but means for state flux.
No, I think I missed your point. You said you do the first measurement and you get some state collapsed or not. It then evolves further. Yes, but these photon eigenstates are eigenstates of the electric field Hamiltonian, electromagnetic field Hamiltonian. So further evolution wouldn't matter. But that's really not a relevant point. Even though I can answer it, it's not really a relevant point. Yeah.
Can you explain in this physical setup what's happening?
You have a two-photon state, and you have a couple of photon detectors, and you ask, what is the probability of detecting a photon at x1 and a photon at x2? And they don't have to be simultaneous. The theory can take account of time differences as well. I just didn't write down the complete theory. That's the measurement that you do. If you ask me how to prepare the state, that's a more difficult question, and you better ask an experimentalist and quantum mathematics how to do that. That's the experiment.
This question. When you measure the first photon, like the state of the first photon is collapsed to the Q state, but does this...
That's what I said there, and it gives the wrong answer.
Does this affect the second photon? Does the second photon also collapse to the Q state?
Well, none of them collapse, as far as I'm concerned. So it's difficult to argue against the position that hasn't been stated, and you only have to infer the position.
Okay.
However...
The reason I'm asking is because you just mentioned that the second photon is in the Q state, and it evolves in time, so that does not change the state, because it's in the average state. And my concern is, the second photon, we are probably not in the Q state.
We could entertain that possibility, but instead of having either this state or this state or this pure state, you could have a density matrix for the second photon. I'm pretty darn sure the density matrix would not predict the interference pattern that's observed in the second article here. I haven't worked that out in detail because nobody specifically advocated that, but I'm pretty sure that won't work out. Maybe I should now remove some of the mystery here. I started out by talking about a two-component system. No. And then I showed that it doesn't matter whether you use projection postulate or not, you get the same answer. Then I give you an example in which you have a two-component system and you get the wrong answer if you use projection postulate. Well, this is a two-component system, but in terms of the first example I gave, my Q and my P, and my Q and my R, I guess it was, the two components of my electromagnetic system are not the two photons, the two modes of the field. Photons are excitations of the field, but when you detect a photon, you don't say that you don't know whether you detected the photon from mode one or the photon from mode two. They have the same frequency, they're indistinguishable. So actually the kind of measurement that I'm talking about here isn't really of the type described in the first example where I said the projection postulate is innocuous. So but I don't think that was obvious. None of you raised that as an objection, so it wasn't obvious. Now we're doing for time. Okay, well, we're getting about to where I figured I ought to get in the first lecture, so that's fine. Okay, in this paper that I referred to for criticizing projection postulate, I've got several examples, but I'll talk about one other, the so-called Quantum-Zeno effect, which also known as the Watch-Pott paradox. I think the word Watch-Pott paradox is more appropriate, but the word Zeno effect is the one that caught on. It is alleged that a continuously observed system will never change its state. The reason for this, roughly speaking, is, well, it takes a little while for an unstable state to decay. It doesn't happen instantaneously. But if you're continuously observing that it hasn't decayed yet, then the projection postulate collapses it back to the initial state, and you just never get it. Now that perhaps is simplifying it a little too much. We need a little bit of mathematics. So let me give you the little bit of basic mathematics that's required to show. Let's calculate the survival probability of an initial unstable state. Well, it's given by this formula. The initial state is psi naught. We operate the time development operator, e to the minus I h t time over h bar, and then project it onto the initial state, take the square. That's the survival probability of this state. For small times, you can expand in the power series in t, and you get 1 minus sigma over t h bar squared, where sigma squared is the variance of the energy. Now, the paradox can be derived in the next step. We want to calculate what is the probability that the unstable state survives for some time capital T, which doesn't have to be small. But what we must do is divide capital T up into n intervals so that T over n is small. So the probability of surviving, so this formula here applies for one of these small intervals. Well, the probability of surviving n successive steps is the product of the probability of surviving, the probability of surviving all n of these steps is the product of the probability of surviving each one. If you don't survive the first one, it's game over. If you do survive the first one, the probability of surviving the second one is the same factor, so you've got to square it. If you survive that, then the probability of surviving the third is cubed, and so on. Passed to the continuous limit, the n going to infinity, and this probability goes to 1, so this gives you the conclusion that the Watch-Pott doesn't work. I really think the Watch-Pott paradox is a better name than the Quantum-Zeno paradox, but the other's caught up. Of course, this is an absurd conclusion. Watch-Potts do boil. I don't see that was straight now.
How do we know that? Like, I mean, no one can watch a pot all the time.
I was watching you all the time, and you moved.
But you
didn't see
you.
I did so.
And then later you saw me in a different state.
No, I saw you move. I was watching your continuous. I don't have to have the stooge as a straight man here. All of a sudden, you volunteer.
I do visual, like, refresh rates. I only see things however many times a second. I think around 30 hertz, I can see something like that.
Your eye is not a television set. Okay, but
is there a continual photon streaming right into you, and how do you avoid the energy problems that that causes?
I don't know, but I don't know that it's relevant either. Let's go on to what is relevant.
I know, you're basically claiming that watch pots boil, but I don't think you can justify that claim.
maybe we should discuss solipsism because you won't be able to prove that that's false either. But that's not the point. The point is that the projection postulate is not a sound model of a measurement process. That's what I'm going to show next.
I was under the impression that that experiment had actually been done.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion. A lot of theoreticians, myself included, wrote papers showing that, in fact, the projection postulate needn't be used, and it was irrelevant. Hesher Perez actually did it better. He showed, let me show what I'm going to show, and then I'll refer to Hesher Perez.
The experimental result was that wash pots don't boil.
No, it wasn't. That was not a correct interpretation of the results.
Okay, fair enough.
How do we characterize, probably going to go over a few minutes, okay? How do we characterize continuous observation? There's been some objections raised about the idealization of continuous observation. And in a way, I was being too hard on you, because there's something to that objection. Let's see what's minimally involved in the measure. This is not a continuous measurement, but we're idealizing a continuous measurement as a sequence of discrete measurements and passing to the continuous measure. Here's a simple model of a measurement where we only have two states of the object, R1 and R2, and two states of the apparatus, A1 and A2, and I postulate an interaction that gives rise to the following unitary transformation. If R is equal to R1, the state of the apparatus doesn't change. That's the first two basis functions. If R is equal to R2, the state of the apparatus changes. There's the unitary matrix that does the job for you. The eigenvectors of that unitary matrix are easy to see. The first two basis functions are there, and even an odd combination of the second two basis functions. The reason for working that out is I want to infer what is the Hamiltonian that will give rise to this unitary operator, and therefore infer what the interaction was. Okay, let us choose as initial state the even combination of the third and fourth basis function. It's going to evolve in the usual way, either the minus I energy times time over h bar times each component. And if we choose the energies conveniently, I took E plus to be 0 and E minus to be minus B, then there's a phase factor E to the I of BT over h bar between. And one thing I said is that this unitary operation, it takes the third basis function into the fourth basis function. Therefore, if we start with this initial state, which is a linear combination of the even and the odd, if we wait half a period so that the sign changes from plus to minus, we'll have the fourth basis function instead of the first. To do that, you see you have to have the product of the interaction strength, which that up there, times the duration of the measurement over h bar equal pop. Now, what happens if we now try to go to the continuous limit? Remember this, V times tau equals constant. V is the interaction strength, tau is the duration of the measure. We want continuous measurements, so tau has to go to 0. That means V has to go to infinity. You have to have an infinitely strong interaction to really do continuous observation. So in a way, you were right. I wasn't continuously observing you, but good enough approximation. The point is that if you insist on going to the continuous limit, then you must have V going to infinity. And it's this infinite interaction that swamps the Hamiltonian and stops the system from moving and causes the Zeno effect. Some conclusions from this is that continuous von Neumann measurements are impossible. A von Neumann measurement, not really familiar with the term, basically it's the kind of measurement to which the projection postulate can be applied, you still get the right answer. Von Neumann measurements just can't be done in the continuous limit. There's an unpublished paper by Phil Perl from some years ago. It used to be hard to get things published in Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. It's much better today. In which he showed, written down for bounded interaction matrix elements, but I'm not sure, maybe I should have said finite rather than bounded. I've forgotten the details of the paper. But in any case, he showed under rather general but realistic circumstances that a strict Zeno effect doesn't occur. And if you want a realistic theory that applies to exactly those experiments that you're referring to, I recommend Hesher Perez's paper. I don't even refer to my own paper anymore, because Hesher's paper was a whole lot better. He did even more. He pointed out that if you're realistic and consider interaction of finite strength, then indeed you will not get the Zeno effect. If you make the strength strong enough in the limit, in this limit, you'll get it. The experiment that was actually done in a limit where this was a reasonable approximation. That is, V was infinite, but it was so large that this was a plausible thing to say. But the moral of the story, as far as I'm concerned, is that you can't glibly talk about the collapse of the state factor after management. And I believe in the original paper on the so-called quantity in effect, that's exactly what the authors did, and that's how they got their effect. And so the original argument was wrong. You can get the effect if you insist on it, but you're going to a very unphysical limit. So these are some examples of situations in which rejection postulate does make a difference, and it makes things go wrong. Okay, that's probably enough for today. If you don't mind. No, not really. I'm not planning on talking about bells here. It's really hard to hear. Yeah.
In your paper, you reject the idea that if you do like an experiment in the PR style, then you use correlation between the spins and so on. You're saying that it's some physical to say that there is actually a effect from one to another.
I don't know how you can discuss Bell's theorem intelligently at the end of a lecture of which Bell's theorem was not part of the talk. I'm sorry, we got it. Maybe we could talk about it privately, but this is not appropriate.
Any other questions?
I'd just like to say, so I mean, you probably felt the same wrong problem. The real problem is how to describe reality. So if your conclusion was, well, some of the theory that is how to describe reality,
well, quantum theory doesn't describe the phenomena, that's the wording that I used. It describes the probabilities of the possible alternatives. What should we do about it? I'm not so sure. Phil Perl's a little more confident. He'll tell you what he's going to do about it. I'm not sure.
My question is, one thing that confused me about your analysis of the Zeno effect, which is that you're referring to a limit of larger
entropy
as being physical, because the experiment was carried out under that condition. So, how
was that happen? The experiment was effectively carried out under conditions large, not if. So, you need to analyze it in more detail, as Asher Perry did. He actually plotted graphs in, not, I don't know whether in that paper, but in another paper, as a function of B or something similar to show what results you get. Basically, you can't, another way of putting it is, you can't have infinitely fine resolution in time. Any measurement has a finite bandwidth. So,
why am I taking all the limits you suggest in the cut off? Aren't we with continuous interactions or infinite interactions? They're pretty much the same limit. And isn't that basically a classical limit? Like, isn't.
Oh,
it certainly looks like a classical limit to me.
I've never heard the classical limit described as V going to infinity.
No,
I don't think so. No, and I think you're wrong. No, because it was the action involved. V times tau is an action, and that action was equal to pi times h bar. And the action was kept constant. Usually a classical limit involves the action going large compared with h bar, and I didn't do that. So I think, no, it's not a classical limit.
But to go towards a continuous interaction kind of limit, it is also not kind of quantumly. I don't know how to express that better.
Well, you expressed it well enough. I just have to say, I think you're wrong. Quantum mechanics, time is continuous. Interactions are continuous. Schrodinger equation is continuous. At this point, that point has come up in more learned discussions than ours, trying to think who was involved. Yadira Aronoff and forget who the other person was. That some of Moma Aronoff's work was objected to on precisely those grounds, and they successfully answered the argument in a different context. But no, I don't think continuum is continuum of time is in any way incompatible with monitoring.
Continuum of time aside, interaction.
No, what do you mean? There's a continuous what's this continuous?
Like my interaction with you, right? It's with the photon.
Well, that's already classic.
Pluton or something. But it's not going to be continuous. There are going to be times, no matter how much I do something, where I'm not interacting.
I don't know. Where's the discontinuity in equation? No, no.
The quantum mechanics interaction between the two interior states is the negative moment mu times mu times the time.
But it shouldn't be, right? When I go to the field theories and stuff, it should end up being photons, right?
Wrong. Photons are not the fundamental elements of field theory at all. They're secondarily derived quantities. The fields are the fundamental elements. So it actually goes further away from what you're saying. You've got to feel.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk, a state in which you have some sort of distribution of the of plane waves, and you're adding up to.
I'm not sure which part of the talk you're referring to.
In the early beginning, you mentioned that there would be some effect, statistical effect, because of, so there's going to be a fine, which has...
Is this an interference experiment?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wondered if you could just add some more mathematical detail, like explain exactly, like what would be the scale of the interference.
I'm not sure what you want.
That would be like a Du Bois wavelength. I think it was inversely with the mass of the system. Is that...
I'm not sure. I think that's a good exercise.
probably is, actually.
Well, to hear about this also when Anton's out here.
Well, actually, I can give you the answer. We had the beam splitting and coming back together. So here's a wave vector k1, here's a wave vector k2, and the interference pattern has a wave vector k1 minus 2 k2, vector difference. And so you can figure out the wavelength from that. That's the scale of the interference pattern. So it depends on both the magnitude of k and the angle between.
Just like around that section in your talk, you were talking about an interference thing that you had an A or something with a position of momentum. It wasn't clear to me anyway exactly what you were talking about. You said if you don't acknowledge like a collapse, then this interference pattern would exist, but we can't measure it, and it's very fine. And if you have the collapse or whatever, then there's no interference at this level. But I didn't quite get that. I'm going to go over that.
Okay, well, that's a summary of what I said. Yeah. But in macroscopic systems, in principle, there are very fine scale interference patterns around. Most cases, they won't be first-order interference. That is, you could never detect them with a single particle detector. They could only be detected in coincidence measurements, coincidences between two particles, and maybe coincidences between the system and the environment, which would be practically impossible, although not conceptually impossible. So that's what I'm saying. In principle, there are all these correlations and interferences, but they get really, really hard to observe.
And why are they there? That's very important.
Because Schrodinger's equation says they're there.
Why are they there? Why are they there?
Why are they like?
Quantum mechanics definitely predicts them to be there.
The thing is, I'm not sure I quite get you. It's because you say that, like, we live in a macroscopically entangled state, and that's okay.
It's really, really entangled. It's not like Schrodinger's cat. It's a whole lot worse.
Yeah.
And the correlations that would exhibit the interference patterns are not one particle or two particle or three particle, something much more complicated, which you haven't a hope in hell observing.
So
yep.
Like,
nowadays you also have a new interpretation on the market, the extended interpretation, that the wave function is the state of knowledge, and the state update rule of the projection postulate is then just reflecting my...
Okay, I'm planning to talk about that a bit in the next lecture.
So my question would then be, what you're saying here would sort of rule out such definition interpretation, is that right? Because
well, we'll have to be clear exactly what that interpretation entails, but I do intend to talk something about the probability and epistemic and interpretations of probability and how that relates to interpretation of quantum mechanics. So that's coming up very soon. Yeah.
Einstein in 1949, I think, said that there is an obvious reason why, there's a simple psychological reason why what he considered the most obvious interpretation of quantum mechanics, namely, that it does not deal with the wave function, does not describe, does not provide a complete description of an individual system. There's a simple psychological reason why this is ignored by most physicists, namely, if in fact they were to accept that the wave function were not the complete description, they would seem to be obliged to find that more complete description. You want to comment on that?
Not really. Einstein put it well enough in his own words. although I think nowadays some people are getting willing to look for what Einstein said they weren't willing to look for in his day.
First, I want to make sure I understand your point of view. So you're saying the wave function is a description of statistics and measurements that we could carry out. But you're not telling us why it happens to play that role. Presumably that has to come from this deeper theory that a couple of people have asked about. Is that your viewpoint?
Close to it. I said that the wave function or the state vector more generally you can think about as a catalog or a generator of probability distributions. I wouldn't necessarily say, I agree with John Bell in that measurement shouldn't be part of the fundamentals, so I wouldn't like to call the probabilities strictly probabilities of measurement, although they are at least probabilities of measurement, but I share Bell's opinion that I don't think measurement should be a fundamental part of the theory, it's an application of the theory. So that's getting close, I guess.
And then secondly, how's this question? Are you claiming that one and the same wave function continues to provide this catalog of probabilities, whatever, for all time? Or are you saying that...
Yeah, I agree with Everett to that extent, yeah. I don't agree with Wheeler and DeWitt. Yeah. In fact,
that looks on the base of it to be obviously wrong, because you have, in the kind of situation you talked about, where the cat is, say, half 50% probability to be seen alive and 50% probability to be seen dead.
Yeah.
You keep using that wave function. We've now seen it alive, but then we've been looking 10 minutes.
You have to look at my paper, Limitations of the Projection Postulate, where I, in more detail than what I did today, I show that there are situations in which you get the same answer regardless of whether you use the projection postulate, and situations in which you get different answers. And you're probably alluding to a situation in which you get the same answer. Sounds like it to me anyway. The same state vector, just because you have a different state vector doesn't mean you have different observables, because state vector isn't observable. It's only a generator of the probabilities. And if you generate the same probabilities with and without the problem, with and without the projection postulate, then there'll be no difference. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you correct. I'm not sure.
We
won't
have to do this tonight. So we have a team moment. Thank you, speaker, again.